All right. That's Brahma. Right? So everything you see, now you go back to the apple, and what have we got is the statement, the ritual I am going through is part of Brahma. You see, my thought about doing this thing is part of Brahma. The offering, meaning the apple, is Brahma. He who is making the offering, meaning me, I'm part of Brahma. The fire to which the offering, the fire that's consuming the offering, meaning my hunger, that's also Brahma. And he to whom I'm making the offering, that's also Brahma. I mean, in other words, if I can conceive of any finite form, which I'll call God, see, keep in mind that's just another manifestation of Brahma. One level down, it's in form. It's finite. Then the last line of that is, he who keeps in mind that all is Brahma goes to Brahma, becomes enlightened, in other words. And then the next part of it is, you offer it, you reverence it, and you offer it to Brahma, which is not that Brahma. It's Brahma then manifested initially in the Hindu pantheon in three manifestations. There were three initial manifestations, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Brahma is the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the destroyer. And so you offer it to each of these three initial manifestations called the Godheads, the Godhead. And then that's Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwara, that's Shiva. Guru Sakshat is the Shiva, the Shakti, Shiva Shakti, the female energy component. You offer it to the female energy component. Param Brahma is the Super Brahma. That's that one back there we were talking about that you remembered you're part of. And finally, you reverence the lotus feet of your guru. And then you ask for peace. Now, you see how eating, now let's see what happens after you've done all that, and then you start to eat. Because this is the game I got caught in. You see, I didn't mind giving up sex, because after all, you're sitting in India anyway, where you don't hardly ever see the women, because they're all hiding behind doors anyway. And it was all right, it was an interesting thing to be doing while I was in India, giving up sex. And I didn't mind being cold, and I didn't mind all the other things, but I'm a very oral guy. See, who I was would say I am a very oral guy. Coming out of a good Jewish family where food and love and all that were all chicken soup, right? And therefore, you know, I didn't mind all the rest of the austerities, but when that food came, it could have been swill from the bucket. And it was the food that I was given, and it was steak from Original Joe's, and it was lobster Savannah from Lockober's, and it was, you know, it was every possible delicacy. I mean, it was just rice and dal, but as far as I was concerned, I ate it with the same getting completely lost in the joy of eating, right? You know, that the delicacy of the flavor and the joy of swallowing, oh, the whole thing, right? And I'd savor and, you know, and overload and just eat and eat everything that was available, you know. And I kept thinking to myself, I'm not going to give this up. Nobody's pushing you, you know, who you're fighting against. So finally, I thought, see, then what? Here's what happened. Every Tuesday, you don't eat, see. It's Mangalam day, you fast for a day. So, okay, I can fast for a day. I used to do it on Yom Kippur all the time. But the difference was in Yom Kippur, around the middle of the afternoon, you start to have fantasies about all the food you're going to eat when the fast is passed, you see. And now these people don't have fast like, you know, it doesn't matter whether they eat or don't eat, right? You're in a different environment. You're not sitting in the temple with everybody saying, are you going home to cook? Okay. Then one day I fasted on Mangalam day, and the next day the guy that usually cooks, the sadhu that usually cooks the food, had a bad tooth and he went somewhere, or he was, something happened, I don't know, and there was no food. So I was being very game about the whole thing, and I just, well, listen, I'm a sadhu. I don't, what's, you know, food? I'll just ignore it. So I didn't eat that day. Next day, the teacher came, and I said, well, I didn't eat for 2 days. It's like, you know, what happens is, see, the very subtle way your ego works is you no sooner finish some little accomplishment on your sadhana, on your spiritual path, than the ego walks behind you and pats you in the back and says, pretty good. That's the way it sort of sneaks back in to take over again. So I said to the guru, the teacher, well, I didn't eat yesterday either. 2 days I didn't eat. He says, well, if it doesn't disturb you, he said, it is good on the full moon every 3 months to go for 9 days. Well, now. Right. Right. That's not 9 days without liquid. You do take liquid, right? Just don't take any solid. He says, it's good for your intestine. Well, all right, by gosh, I'll do it. Right? Well, you get a little weak around the fourth day, and my fantasies are, you know, I would, like, I lie in on my mat. It's not in bed, you're on a mat, see? And I lie on my mat, and I would think about Thanksgiving. And I'd think about the squash with the marshmallows on it. And all the things I'd never have again, see? And, oh, I was so full of self-pity. Oh, and I'd recite the whole thing, and I'd be out raking leaves in my head, and I'd smell the turkey cooking, and then I'd go in, and I'd see the pumpkin pies, and, oh, boy, I just created the whole thing, and I spent 9 days just locked in oral fantasies of the most extraordinary nature, right? Which, since I hadn't given up a desire or attachment, the act of fasting was had no spiritual value particularly at all, except it showed me where I wasn't. Well, by the second round, I had changed, the second three-month time when that came up. So this time, it was very interesting. My fantasies now weren't about turkey or lobster or any of the things I'd never have again. Now they were about spinach. And big piles of brown rice. You know, all the things I could eat again, I just had limited my fantasy life now to what was going to be available to me. But I was still having these fantasies, and I was still very locked in food, and it lasted much through the winter. And then I remember what happened. I tried every device. I tried the Southern Buddhist meditation, which is like a cemetery meditation, where you look at your bags of intestines, and you look at the food is, you know, worm-ridden and all that, and you're eating it, and, you know, and it certainly didn't make it a groove, but I still ate with great relish, you know. It's all right, worms, you know, some people eat ants. And I couldn't quite break out. I couldn't quite break out. And it was no matter what I did, when the food came, like, it was just like I was a ravenous animal. It had nothing to do with being a holy man. And I tried very hard all the methods I knew of not, you know, not being attached to the food, but I couldn't work it. And then I started to do a meditation, which is created by Ramana Maharshi, called Vichara Atma. And this meditation says, it says, who am I? I am not my body. And then you feel your body and you experience the I inside your head as separate from the body. Then you say, I am not my senses. And you watch each of the senses receiving its information and you see the I as separate from that sense. Now that process, for example, when you're sitting in a room and there's a clock ticking and you pick up a book to read, you don't hear the clock tick when you're caught in the book. And then the minute you finish with the book, you hear the clock tick again. Well, you've all had that experience. Well, when the clock is ticking continuously, it continues to tick. Your ear continues to your auditory nerve continues to receive, but your attention is not there. That's where that break came, and it came involuntarily. Well, you learn to do it voluntarily, to turn off each of these senses, to see it happening. You see your ear hearing. You see your eye seeing, but you see it from the I place, which is not the air, and it's not the eye, and it's not the skin, and so on. Then you say, I am not the five organs of action, and it's the arms and the legs and the tongue and the anus and the genitals. And you go through each of these and experience it, and experience it separate from the eye. Then I am not the five internal organs, and you go through breathing and respiration and excretion and perspiration and digestion. Same way. Then you get to the clincher, which is the last line, which says, I am not this thought. You see? Now you've gotten to the point where there's just the I thought left in the middle of your head. I, see, I am not this, I am not that, I am not that. And then you say, I am not this thought. Now the thought, I am not this thought, is the thought you are not. Dig that? So it's just like your thoughts become like on the Times building in New York where the news is going by on a ticker. That's where your thoughts are. They're out there. And where you are, you can't label, because any label is a thought. All right, you're appreciative of that problem. You see, it's a vehicle for pushing you beyond your mind. It's beautiful. It takes you to the true self, he says. All right. Now, you go into that place, I am not this thought. And then you go back into this first state of bliss. You go into a great calm bliss place. And the minute you slip out, you know, you have another thought. Well, who's thinking that? Well, who am I? Well, I am not the, and you go right back in again. See? Well, I worked with it for quite a while until finally I was in this blissful state. And then one day it happened. I was sitting in this state, just sitting there, and the food came along, and I said, oh, man, it's the food. I mean, am I going to stop this for that? And I thought, wow, isn't that interesting? I noticed this. I mean, this really blew my mind to have this happen. It was blowing, literally. That was what happened, of course. And I thought, well, gee, maybe I can eat without leaving this state. So I started to eat just as if it was just happening, but I wasn't in it. I was watching myself eat. In the Southern Buddhist method, it's called eating, eating. You watch eating, eating, chewing, chewing, swallowing, swallowing. You know, digesting, digesting. Thinking about food, thinking about food. But you who is doing all that is behind all that, the witness. And I watched the whole thing, and all the fun was gone out of eating. One second, I'll stop.
Excuse me. Those who want to take 5:30.
Gotcha. Those that you have to leave, I won't say anything interesting after this. So. Although I'll talk all night. I don't. Now, what had happened clearly was that I had gone to a place where that attachment, even that attachment, was starting to fall away. And that was the subjective experience that went along with it. That was the first time that had happened for me ever in my life that I could remember about food. It was like you'd just eaten a huge meal, that indifference you have to food. Now, you see, the game that I was learning, which is very well reflected in the Satipatthana Vipassana, the Southern Buddhist meditation, is the problem of labeling everywhere your attachment goes, everywhere your mind goes. And by the process of labeling, you extricate yourself from the desire or from the feeling. I'll go through that a little later when I get to meditation. So that was eating. And then after lunch, I'd lay around. Sometimes I'd lie in the sun and make believe I was on the Riviera. And beautiful women were feeding me grapes and things. And sometimes I just sat in the sun and prayed to the sun. And I learned mantras, beautiful mantras, like Aditya Hridayam Punyam Sav Shatru Bina Shanam. All evil vanishes from life for he who keeps the sun in his heart. And every time I see the sun, in the day when I first come out, the sun is there. The first thing I do, Aditya Hridayam Punyam Sav Shatru Bina Shanam. And I feel that Because it's the same thing. Remember, I said light, energy, consciousness, love. The sun is consciousness. It's one level down into grossness because it's in the physical universe. Now, I will digress here since I said in the physical universe to make a very critical point that is going to shake many of you. And I'll say it very baldly. The journey to enlightenment is basically a struggle against nature. And it is only when you are enlightened that you can be once again in form, because at the same moment you are in formlessness. And nature is form. Now, what I mean by nature is the following. It's everything from Purusha below Purusha, all forms of energy, no matter how fine they are. Your mind is part of energy. Your body is part of nature. Your body is part of nature. Electricity is part of nature. Light's part of nature. The trees are part of nature. All your senses are part of nature. The image is given by Ramakrishna. The story comes from the Ramayana by Tulsidas. When Rama, this very pure reincarnation of God, was sent out into the woods, he went off with his wife Sita, who was a very pure woman, and Lakshman, his brother, who reverenced his brother Ram very much, because Ram was God in this incarnation. And what happened was that Lakshman would walk third in line, and therefore, during the jungle paths, he would never see Ram. And every now and then, Sita would stand aside on the path so Lakshman could see Ram. And that is the way in which the Hindus conceive of nature as being the mother nature, or Maya, or illusion, or that which is form, which hides you from experiencing that other place to the extent that you're attached to it. And it is within that context, then, that you can understand the meaning of what sexual continence is about, you see, because sexual continence would seem to go against our responsibilities as evolutionary beings within the species and for reproduction of the species. Now that's very heady stuff to think about, because when you see the cycle, the way it works, there is what we have called Darwinian evolution, or the evolution of the species, which is all in nature, bringing man up to the point where he has an intellect, a rational mind, which is then capable of knowing itself, which is the first vehicle that is suitable for the breakthrough to see the fact that all of this is illusion. Pure consciousness has existed in everything always, in always the same way. So it is only that in the evolutionary cycle, they get to the point where you have a human birth where you can be conscious of the ignorance you have lived with. But you've always been fully conscious. It's always been there in you, in every organism, in everything. Same consciousness. This is all consciousness. This is all consciousness. Now, if you want to see the way, if you want to feel your way through how it works, see, there's a hard time we in the West have with a word like soul. But the way in which the Hindus conceive of it is that at the moment of conception, when the sperm and the egg, sperm fertilizes the ovum. At that moment, you enter. You enter in your full consciousness into that natural phenomenon, into that part of nature. Now, the reason you, what is you that enters? You can think of you that enters as composed of two components. One is pure Atman, it's called, which is that which is God in all of us, which is that element of consciousness which is pure and untouched. It's the Purusha. It's that little bit of Purusha that's in you in this particular form, although all your cells are that too in another level. I hope I'm not confusing you. I'm trying to get this across. Now, what else is there that is you at that point? What else there is that is you is what would be called your sanskaras. That is your potentials or your uniquenesses that you're bringing from previous runs on the cycle, previous runs into nature. You're going in and out of nature. And you pick up so much disequilibrium. It's really what sanskaras boil down to is the relationship of the three gunas, of rajas, tamas, and sattvic, of purity, energy, and lethargy, or darkness, movement, and lightness. When these are in pure balance, you are in the Purusha, you're pure consciousness, you're an enlightened being. But the minute there's a disbalance, which is like, it's like maybe a free-moving electron goes through a field and creates a whole scene around it of disequilibrium. That's the level at which you can think of the prime cause, if you want to play with prime cause, although it's a reasonably trivial question to play with because we can't solve it. But if you think about this disequilibrium, you come into that fertilized ovum as merely Atman encased in that disequilibrium proportion or that propensity. But that propensity is what determined what ovum you come into, which is determines your whole life experience. That is your karma that you're going to live out in this lifetime. Now, you've got to understand that the place you came from, the Atman, that place behind it all, is outside of time. And this is finally the area where Western physics is finally getting close to the place, because they are finally dealing with the matter of the relative nature of time. And the time is merely is our construct rather than the way in which it all is. Now, you come from this timeless place, and what determines, you see, and this, by the way, is where astrology comes into it, you see, because the particular configuration of planets at that point of your, of the fertilization is a through probably a magnetic field of some sort at that level of energy, a very pure form of energy, is a determinant of the chemical makeup of that organism, of the, you could call it the endocrine system. That's a reasonable way in which they're linked. That various planetary configurations, it's just like, I mean, the simplest way of saying it is, our body is 90-some-odd percent water, and the moon makes the tides go up and down, and the moon affects our bodies also, because they're mostly water. Well, in the same way, the different chemical compositions of the different planets have magnetic pulls on the different chemical compositions in our body, and the different organs or endocrine systems have different chemical makeups, and they are differentially affected by these planetary configurations. It seems very big and very little to be related, but there is a relationship. It's interesting that in India, all marriages are planned by the astrologer in the villages, because they know that the information you're going to get through your senses has nothing to do with your long-range compatibility. And therefore, they'll work it out according to these other kinds of things. All right, now you're born then into this, you get born, you go through the fetal stage and you get born, and you're a neonate, 7-pound neonate. Now, 7-pound neonate, if you knew at that point, if you were fully conscious, you would know that you were still fully conscious and you were just in a 7-pound neonate. However, the 7-pound neonate gets hungry and it cries. There's hunger and crying and so on. And everybody around you treats you as if you're that neonate. It's just as if you came off the assembly line at Detroit and you drove the car off the line, and then everybody treated you as if you were the car. You went through your whole life thinking you were a Chevrolet. Therefore, because you were a Chevrolet, you had to drive down roads a certain way, and you had to park in garages a certain way, and you developed a whole concept of the universe based on you being a Chevrolet. While in fact, it was merely the illusion. You got caught in the desires, in the entrapment of the nature of that part of nature which you were in.
You've got your feet on the mic.
It now then may take you all your lifetime or many lifetimes to wake up to the realization that this particular bizarre circumstance had happened. That you got caught in this thing, in this wrong model of who you were. And it's called the veil, or the dust in the eyes, or the veil of ignorance, or your sanskaras, or whatever. There are thousands of words that describe the thing that made us think for a mistake that I was that body, so that when I lost the body in that first drug session, I got frightened. I mean, if I get out of my Chevrolet, I'm not going to get frightened. Even if the Chevrolet goes over a cliff, if I'm not in it, even if I think I'm my body, because I don't think I'm the Chevrolet. But I didn't realize I was in a rent-a-body. You know, not only a rent-a-body, but a rent-a-mind. A rent-a-mind, everybody. That my rational thought process was in nature as well. That was part and parcel of the whole trip I bought when I got born into this thing. But it's certainly been seductive, and I certainly thought I was thinking, and that my thoughts were me. I'm a thinking being. Now, it is for these reasons that I say that the problem is getting free of nature. So that when you... Like, I'm up in New Hampshire in a little cabin, see, up in the woods, up in Franklin at my father's farm. And all around are beautiful trees, and they got red leaves and golden leaves and yellow leaves. And always in the past, I came up to New Hampshire in the autumn to dig the leaves. So I'm sitting in my cabin, and the shutters are all down, and I'm sitting there, and somebody comes in and says, "How can you be in here when all the leaves are so beautiful?" And I say, because I'm not yet free enough to be able to be with the leaves without getting caught in the beauty. Getting caught in the beauty. Now, this business of being caught is the critical matter that is the first step that people undertake in the road to becoming liberated. It is the technique which Gurdjieff has so exquisitely enunciated in his model of self-remembering. And Gurdjieff says it in one way, and Rodney Collin, the disciple of Uspensky, says it in a slightly different way. Gurdjieff says, your problem is that you identify. You learn to identify as a child with your body, then you identify with your mother's concept of who you are, so you develop social roles, and you identify with the concepts of the universe all around you, so you become a thinking, rational being in a rational system. And then pretty soon when you're angry, you say, "I'm angry," and you identify with the anger, and you are anger. And you identify with being in love, and you identify with desires, and you identify with your lusts, and you identify with everything. Just go from one thing. You identify with other people's opinions of you, what Dave Reisman calls the other-directed man. Rodney Collin calls it fascination. He says we're like bees. We just are so fascinated by everything. We're just like going from flower to flower. Like, if you're listening to me and just hearing my words and aren't conscious at this moment that you're listening to me and hearing my words, you're fascinated. You're trapped. That's where you're at. That's what it comes down to. Because all the time I'm talking to you, I'm going, that mantra is going on and on inside of me. And from that place, which is completely outside of this game of lecture and our visiting together, I'm watching this whole drama unfold, just like I were one of the actors on the stage. No fascination at all. I'm in the same place as if I'm saying Om Mani Padme Hum in my cabin in New Hampshire or in the ashram in India. Same place. There's no place to go. There's no place you ever go. You're always in the same place. When you begin to realize there's nowhere to go, it's quite shaky, shaking at first. Driving and driving, and there's nowhere to go. You're not getting anywhere because you're there. You're here. Now, the fascination or identification, if you understand that concept, that is the attachment to your senses, and that is the game, is to get free of that. And the process of self-remembering is the process of developing the witness, or in Ramana Maharshi's terms, the I thought. That is that place from which you observe all of your desires, all of your attachments, all of your feelings. Just like Bhagwan Das said to me, the feeling is a wave that's disappearing off into the distance. Well, in the same way, when first what happens is, as you, those of you that have studied the Gurdjieff system know, you say, all right, I'm going to self-remember. There I am, self-remembering. And then something comes along and you start to get angry and you so forget your self-remembering because you're so busy, why, that son of a, I'm going to, and about 2 days later you wake up and say, holy mackerel, wasn't I self-remembering at that point? And you completely forgot you're even trying to do it, see? So you say, okay, well, I'll start again. So you start again, and this time maybe you only fall asleep for a day and a half. And if you keep at it, if you really work at it as hard as you work to learn how to drive a car, for example, pretty soon you get down so that you get to the point where you keep falling asleep just as often, but you wake up very quickly. And then you get to the point where, like, what happens to me now is I start to get angry, and the starting to get angry is the cue, the stimulus, that pushes me back into the self-remembering. And I say, there I go, starting to get angry. The minute I say, there I go, starting to get angry, I have now identified myself with the witness. And I am no longer the angry. I am now the person who is observing the angry. And by doing that, I have just extricated myself from going through the attachment to that emotion through that whole cycle. You see how that works? Am I getting through to you? Okay. Therefore, that method of developing the witness is a tremendously powerful first step of a two-step operation to on this journey, because you begin, what you do is you just observe your that which is in nature doing its thing. You observe the laws of nature as you are they, as you are they, yeah. Just like you watch a tree drop its seeds and germinate and grow and watch big oaks out of acorns grow and all that, you watch the laws of your own personality. You watch the laws of your own desires. You just watch them. The witness doesn't do anything. This is very, very critical. See, a kid will come up to me and he'll say, well, I'll tell you, I use the witness. He said, I'm Catholic and I have, sometimes I masturbate and then I say, oh, damn it, you did it again. Now, that's the witness. I said, no, man. The witness says, there I am masturbating. And then the witness says, there I am damning myself for masturbating. All the witness is a witness. The witness is the non-game place. The witness is not active. The witness doesn't do anything. A witness isn't witnessing. The witness is just the I. E-Y-E or I, spiritual I. It's merely there. It's always there. It's always there. And it does nothing. It's got no vested interest, no morality, no laws, no game going. It doesn't care what you do. All it does is see it all. Right? Now, how do you develop the witness? Well, there are devices that are designed to help you develop the witness. Heuristic devices. Rodney Collins says the problem is that you get so fascinated with things like anger or the candle flame or whatever it is that you become the thing itself. And therefore, there are thousands of me's, but there's always like you and the thing. That's the relationship. He says what to do is to introduce a third thing into the system. It's just like, let's say you're doing something that you've always done. Say you do asanas, and you're doing your asanas, and you've always done them alone in your room, and then suddenly somebody's standing there just watching you do them. Well, now, what happens, whether you like to think of it at all, is that which is your ego gets called into play, and you are observing how he's seeing your asanas. Okay? Now imagine that that third person, that person, so that there's you and like the book you're reading, and then there's somebody else there, is somebody who's like my guru. He's a perfect mirror. He's got no game going at all. No game going at all. He doesn't care whether I read the book or don't read the book. He's just saying, reading the book. Reading the book. That kind of a consciousness. So Rodney Collins says, it doesn't matter who you put in there as the third person. You can call it the witness. You can call it Buddha consciousness, and you can read about Buddha and think about Buddha and keep Buddha with you all the time so that every time you're anywhere, Buddha's there too. That's the third person. You can read about Christ and keep Christ there. You can read about the guru, keep the guru there. You can read, you can think about the sun. Aditya Hridayam Punyam Sav Shatru Binashanam. All evil vanishes from life for he who keeps the sun in his heart. There's the third thing, the sun in your heart.